Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher and Wellness Wednesday. Flu season is peaking early, and the increasing number of cases have put the United States in flu epidemic territory. Governor of New York Andrew Cuomo declared a public health emergency for the state this weekend, and Ohioans have also been touched by this illness. Joining us now to talk about the flu this year is Dr. Julie Mangino. She's medical director for the Department of Clinical Epidemiology at Ohio State University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate your taking time to talk about this topic.
I want to ask our listeners whether or not you've been vaccinated this flu season. And if you haven't been vaccinated, give us a call and tell us why not. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Julie, what makes the flu this year so much worse than years past? I mean, not counting the H1N1 scare a few years ago.
Well, I think that some of the things that are making it worse is that we're experiencing the increased number of cases earlier than we normally see it, which is in January and February. So those folks who said, oh, well, I'll get it after Christmas to get the vaccine might have been sort of caught behind the eight ball.
There was talk that the vaccine, well, can you tell us what a vaccine really is? It's not just one strain, it's many strains, or how do they come up with what the vaccine is supposed to go for?
So that's a very important question because we always try and do our very best to anticipate the strains that are going to be circulating, and we start production of these vaccines 6 to 9 months before the flu season actually even begins. So we have two strains of influenza A, and they have different names. H1N1 was one of the components, and H3N2 is the other component of the influenza A strain that's in the vaccine. And then we have a strain of influenza B. So it's called trivalent, meaning three vaccine components in the flu shot or in the live vaccine that's by nasal.
My guest is Dr. Julie Mangino. She's medical director for the Department of Clinical Epidemiology at OSU. We'd like to hear from our listeners. If you have not gotten your vaccination yet or at all, give us a call and tell us why. 614-292-8513. You can also post it on Facebook, and you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. At Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center, you've noticed 10 hospitalizations for flu so far this year and 66 in December.
Correct.
So do these flu sufferers have anything in common?
So a number of the patients have had chronic medical conditions. They're older, which is really the population that influenza hits most hard, although the healthy folks can be pretty sick as well. The elderly have the highest risk of having complications from influenza. What are complications from influenza? So you can get all the symptoms of influenza with fever and chills, and then the complication that you may get would be a pneumonia after the initial infection with influenza. And we see this in people with chronic medical conditions such as asthma, chronic obstructive lung disease, heart conditions, diabetes, and the immune-suppressed type of patients, and very importantly, a young and relatively healthy group, pregnant women.
Can you talk about the herd concept? I'm always fascinated by this, that getting a vaccination isn't necessarily just about you.
That's correct. So the term is herd immunity. And that what that basically means is that if enough people in the population or the hospital or the local community or your office, as an example, get the flu shot, you will decrease the risk of cross-transmission because you've already cut by over half or 66% the likelihood that you're going to acquire the influenza. So it's really herd immunity is the development of a lower risk of contracting influenza as the population in question is protected. And the best protection we currently have is the flu shot, along with some basic things like hand washing and alcohol hand rub and not touching your face and coughing in your sleeve, those kinds of basic things.
Stephanie in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Mangino of the Department of Clinical Epidemiology at OSU. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Thank you. I have made the personal choice not to get vaccinated this year, and I was just wondering if the doctor can speak a little bit about some of the complications from a flu shot. Specifically, I'm interested in why it's contraindicated for pregnant women and children under 6 months. I'm wondering what's so bad that they shouldn't have it, yet everyone else in the population, more or less, should be deemed, you know, able to get the vaccine. I can listen off the air if that's all right.
That's fine. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
No, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. So first, we should clear up misconception. Pregnant women are first and foremost to get the vaccine. Pregnant women must get the vaccine. And the reason we want pregnant women to get the vaccine is to decrease the risk of transmission to the baby while they're pregnant. And then once the baby is born, the baby does not have necessarily all of the antibodies. The immune system is not working as well. So we don't want the mother, who's in very close contact with that baby, to infect the baby. So pregnant women should get the flu shot. Babies less than 6 months of age the vaccine has not been studied in babies less than 6 months of age. So that vaccine is not given at that moment until 6 months of age, and then all of the population greater than 6 months of age can get the flu shot.
So what are side effects to the flu shot in general?
So I would say the major side effect to flu shot, and I can tell you this from personal experience for decades of getting the flu shot, you get a sore arm. You may have a slightly elevated temperature. And that would be, sometimes some people report that they get a headache. And I look upon all of those symptoms as, wow, my body is making antibodies, starting to make antibodies, which takes up to 2 weeks, against those circulating strains of virus. So I take that as really a good thing. I know it must be working.
Bill in Johnstown, you're on the air. Welcome, Bill. Hello, Bill.
Hello. I've received the vaccination. There's no problems there. I have a friend that claims she won't get the vaccination only because it contains mercury. Is this true? It sounds kind of far-fetched to me. And thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Bill.
So mercury is part of the component of thimerosal, which is the preservative that has been used in vaccines to keep the vaccine sterile. And I'm under the impression that most recently, since 1999, that has been removed from most of the vaccines because there was a concern. I believe that there are most of the circulating vaccines that are out there now are preservative-free, and that they are the single-dose vials that don't have the thimerosal in them.
Is there a law that requires they be mercury-free, or is that just a thing they've done to satisfy the market?
Well, mercury is a heavy metal that can be damaging in very, very high doses, and that's where there was the possible concern related to thimerosal and autism.
Mm-hmm.
But most, I think there were about 6 or 7 studies that have been done that you really were not at a greater risk for autism if you got a vaccine with thimerosal than if you didn't. So these days, thimerosal is in very few vaccines in the U.S. So.
Okay. John in Akron, you're on the air with Dr. Julie Mangino from the Ohio State University's Department of Clinical Epidemiology.
Oh, hi, Ann.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I went to the drugstore last night, and I put a mask on and gloves because I realized everybody sick is coming there. I worry, do I need to sanitize the merchandise I buy, bags? And worry about the mailman bringing me germs. Any comment?
So I would say the best tack to take on things that you're in contact with outside of your home would be practicing good hand hygiene. That is, washing your hands with soap and water frequently or using the alcohol hand rub product. And avoid touching your face. So if, for example, if you're concerned about the product you purchased at the store and then you brought it home, I would say the best thing to do is open it up, wash your hands, and after you've opened it up and thrown away the container, and you don't have to worry about any cross-contamination there. The virus can live on inanimate objects for up to a number of 8 hours, I believe. So I think that's an important thing. After that, it won't be. And one of the big areas we are most concerned about is when people cough and cover their cough with their hands and then touch the doorknob, because that's when you, the unsuspecting victim who may not have been vaccinated, could pick up the virus.
All right, John in Akron, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. We have an email from Sarah. She says, I keep having people tell me that the flu shot caused them to get the flu. Can you please debunk this myth?
That is a very common myth. I think as my answer earlier in the program, when you get the flu shot, you're getting a small amount. And in the shot, it's killed virus that's injected into your arm. And you can develop the sore arm, the headache, and the temperature elevation. You will not be developing influenza, which is associated with extremely high fevers, overwhelming muscle and body aches, runny nose, sore throat, etc. Those are the symptoms. Now, it takes up to 2 weeks for the antibodies to be fully functional and fighting your coming in contact with the influenza virus. So if along the way, and we have seen this happen, folks have gotten the flu shot 2 days prior and they develop influenza. And it's because their body hadn't made the antibodies yet to protect them. So you cannot get influenza from the flu shot.
But you might get flu because the flu shot hasn't taken effect yet.
Exactly.
Okay. Dr. Mangino, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. I listen to your show all the time, Ann.
Thanks. It's Dr. Julie Mangino. She's medical director for the Department of Clinical Epidemiology at Ohio State University. Coming up, we're going to talk about starting healthy habits and breaking bad habits. We'd like you to share your stories about starting healthy habits. Let's keep it positive. If you have done that and sustained it, give us a call and tell us how. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Oh. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, with so many Americans scraping by, we'll look at debt traps and who's most vulnerable. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. And stay right here later this hour. Just around noon, President Obama and Vice President Biden will be speaking about proposals related to gun violence. We will have live coverage. Join us here on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 33 degrees with cloudy skies, a high right around 36 today. Clouds tonight and a low of 26. Partly sunny and a high of 36 for tomorrow. Support comes from Marburn Academy, inviting families of prospective students in grades 1 through 12 to a winter admission open house Sunday afternoon, January 27th. For ADHD and dyslexic students, the path to college begins at a Marburn Academy admission open house. More at marburnacademy.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're 16 days into the new year, so how are your resolutions holding up? Could you use some help? Jeremy Dean, a researcher at University College London and a creator of the Cyblog, has written a book about the science of habits and how to make the good ones stick and how to quit the bad ones. His new book is called Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. Welcome to the show, Jeremy Dean.
Thank you very much, Anne. Good to be with you.
I'm asking our listeners again, have you ever tried to start a healthy habit? Did you succeed? Give us a call and tell us how. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So first of all, Jeremy Dean, you're not into the whole New Year's resolution thing, right?
No, I'm not a massive fan of it. And I think it's partly because of that idea that it's got built into it, that we're going to totally transform ourselves in a couple of weeks. And these habits, these bad habits normally that we're trying to change, are so long established, you know, it's going to be very difficult to make those changes. And we have this idea that that we're going to be able to make quite big changes, whereas, you know, there's quite a bit of research out there showing that even relatively small changes can be difficult to make. So I'm perhaps more a fan of the new month's resolution rather than the New Year's resolution.
Whenever you start or try to start a good habit, is that something that's supposed to be replacing a bad habit? Or conversely, when you're trying to stop a bad habit, should you be replacing it with something necessarily?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the things I think that comes up a lot. And naturally, I think people do try to suppress bad habits, push them down, you know, things like smoking or with healthy eating, particular types of foods. And there's this long line of research in psychology showing that and what happens when you try to suppress a thought is it comes back even stronger. And it's like this old thing, try not to think about a pink elephant, and that's the first thing that comes to mind. And it's exactly the same thing with habits. So, yeah, the key is to try to replace that bad habit with a good one, and hopefully something that is incompatible with the bad habit. So with smoking, for example, you might choose chewing gum. Because it's quite difficult to smoke and chew gum at the same time.
You talk about how the smallest habits strung together pretty much make up most of our days. And when people keep diaries of what they do from moment to moment, that is, seems to be the case. And that most of what we do is a function of habits. We are a series of habits.
Yeah, and it does sound a little bit depressing when you think about it like that. And it makes me feel a bit like a robot walking around. And of course, in some ways, there are large parts of our minds that do act in that way. We do have that autopilot that allows us to get loads of things done automatically that are good for us, you know, and the vast majority of our habits probably are good for us. Things like looking both ways before you cross the road or putting on your seatbelt before you pull away. So this kind of autopilot is keeping us safe and on time and in our jobs and so on, and allowing our limited amount of attention, limited amount of sort of conscious attention, to be directed to more important places.
Is it easier to form a healthy or unhealthy habit?
I suppose it'll depend massively on the types of habit that you're trying to form. And there's been some research done a couple of years ago at UCL looking at how long it takes to form different types of habits. And there was one person in the study trying to drink a glass of water in the morning, and they'd made that a habit after 2 or 3 weeks, something like that. And there was another guy in the study, he was trying to do some sit-ups, and that took him, well, months and months, actually. And so there's going to be massive variation, I think, between people, and depending on the types of habit that you're trying to ingrain.
What is the difference between a habit and an addiction?
Yeah, this comes up, and I think one of the best examples is with smoking. And what we tend to think of as addiction is related to the nicotine, so that dose of nicotine going into the brain and making you feel good. But there's also a habitual element to smoking as well, which is the behavioral part of it, like you like to have a cigarette while you're having a cup of coffee or with friends or at a particular time of day, or in response to a particular emotion. So there's a whole kind of behavioral side to it as well. And we tend to think, you know, that these two things are separate, but they can go along together. And I've heard people say with smoking that the actual behavioral part of it can be more difficult to quit than what we think of as the addiction, the nicotine.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Jeremy Dean. He's a researcher at University College London. He's also creator of SciBlog, and he's the author of a new book on the science of making and breaking habits. We'd like to hear from our listeners. If you've started a healthy habit, give us a call and tell us how you sustained it. 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tristan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Tristan.
How's it going?
Good.
So, yeah, well, you know, we were, you know, talking about habits. I actually had more of a full lifestyle change. And when I was in college, I kind of struggled with my weight. And it wasn't until I moved to Japan for 2 years that all changed. And I kind of realized that the habits that were keeping me from losing weight were more, I want to say, I guess, social. When I moved over there, my diet completely changed. You know, when we would go out to dinner with friends, instead of having sodas to choose from and having all these varieties of sodas, they would give you free green tea, or you would have all these different options of different Japanese teas. And the food portion sizes were smaller, and the way that they ate, you know, not as much meat, a lot more vegetables. And after being over there for about, I think it was about 3 months, I ended up losing 50 pounds.
Wow.
And I kind of realized when I came back, I think I was there for about 6 months before I came back to visit my family. I came back to the United States, and I was absolutely shocked at the way people ate. And, you know, it wasn't something that I noticed when I lived here, because it was normal. You know, my friends ate at McDonald's. My friends would always get soda. Mm-hmm. And as a result, I would eat at McDonald's. I would get a soda, and I would do a lot of what my friends did, and I've kind of realized that it seems like in a lot of unhealthy habits, it's got a lot to do with our environment, you know, things we learn from our family.
Jeremy Dean?
Yeah, this is one of the things that comes out in the research again and again, which is that situations are really important, and you're saying there, Tristan, that you're moving to a different country and your habits are changing. And that's quite often what we find is at the at these breaking points in people's lives when they change their environments, then the habits that go with them tend to change as well. And you also mention your friends and the people around you. And of course, people around us have a quite large effect on our habits. We like to go, generally speaking, along with other people and do the same kinds of things as they do. So, yeah, absolutely, situations will make a big difference. And, you know, the country that you're in, and, you know, the advertising that you're bombarded with, the things that other people are doing and so on, are all going to affect us.
Tristan, did you keep the weight off?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I managed to keep the weight off. The best thing I did was I married a Japanese woman. So
okay. Cheater.
I brought her back with me. She's my secret to my diet. But, you know, the main thing is that we've kept, for the most part, a Japanese diet since I moved back to the United States. So it's been easy for me to keep that healthy lifestyle because we live it every day. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been trying to help my parents, and I keep trying to explain to them that you can't cut just, you know, soda out. You can't just stop doing things. You have to make a complete lifestyle change.
Well, but Jeremy Dean, let's talk about that a little bit, because that is what can be so daunting for some people. And Tristan, thanks for your call.
Yeah, this is the problem, and some people do find it very difficult to change because, let's face it, we can't all move to a different country or, you know, marry a different person to change our habits. Most of us are in the same situations every day, so we've got to find other ways of making changes that are going to be sustainable.
Susie in Columbus, welcome to the show. You wanted to talk about weight as well. Now, you were forced to deal with your weight. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. I actually am one of the first generation, I'm now in my 30s, of young people who were diagnosed with type 2 diabetes really young. It came right before my 21st birthday. It was devastating because I thought, you know, this is a serious thing. This is something my grandparents get. This is not something I should be having to deal with right now. And I'd always dealt with weight issues. I'd always dealt with lifestyle issues. And, I mean, my dad joked around and he said, nothing makes you take your life more seriously than when somebody says, hey, this is a big, you know, impetus to your lifestyle, to your longevity, and if you don't take care of this, you're not going to live as long. So that kind of kickstart me into thinking about what do I need to do? And I think for most people, you have to find your motivation. So whether that's your kids, whether that's your loved ones, whether that's, you know, something that you really want, you have to want it if you make these small changes. And I kind of agree with the idea that I understand that you can't just cut out sodas and expect everything to get better. But I think people get daunted by the scope of the project. If my doctor had come in and told me, you have to do X, Y, and Z all the same, change it right now, I wouldn't have done any of them. I would have been, you know, paralyzed with all the things that was ahead of me. But I had a really wonderful doctor, and they just said, I want you to make one small change. And then the next time I saw him, I want you to make this small change. And it was additive. And it was, if I could succeed with one thing and keep it going, then add another component to it. And it has to, I think that's a really effective way to make lifestyle changes, because then you're not looking at this huge, daunting task. You're looking at small, bite-sized pieces that you can do. Can I choose to not have a soda? If I really like soda, can I have a diet soda and then maybe taper off diet soda to something different? So I thought that, you know, it's a lifelong struggle, I think, for a lot of people to manage their weight. But it doesn't have to happen like the, I guess, speaker said, because it's New Year's and I have to do something in 3 weeks, and this 3-week life change is going to make everything better. I think it's good to be realistic, pat yourself on the back for the small changes, but keep going and build on them.
Jeremy,
that's really helped for me.
Thank you, Susie. Jeremy Dean?
I'd agree with all that. I think that's very good advice indeed.
I think the point that Susie made about motivation struck me. I remember when I was trying to quit smoking, and I was in one of those smoke stopper classes. This was, you know, 30 years ago, and I didn't know if I was going to make it until one of the women in the class started crying and calling it her cigarettes her best friend. And I thought, I never want to call cigarettes my best friend. And that was all the motivation I needed. Making and breaking habits works differently.
Well,
it's not like an opposite.
Well, I would say that when you're trying to break a habit, you're always looking to replace it with a new one. So in that sense, you're sort of doing the same thing. When you're breaking a habit, you're trying to make a new habit. But the difference between the two is when you're trying to break a habit, you've got this existing pattern underneath. As both of the callers have been saying, you know, whether it's when it's eating, whether you're in a different country or you're trying to make some change to your sort of what you're routinely eating, there's always this kind of default position that you're battling with. And I think that's one of the things that people have a problem with at the start. It's kind of that hump that you've got to get over, and you have to repeat actions in the same situations to build up habits. And the key is, one of the things I talk about in the book is, the key is you want to try to avoid relying on your willpower too much, because for most of us, our willpower will fail, and we need to build up our habits so that we're automatically doing the right things in the right situations.
Sometimes when people change their habits, they want everybody around them to change their habits as well.
Yeah, it's very difficult to change our own habits, so even more difficult to change other people's habits. But I suppose one of the things we've already touched on is the fact that other people do affect our habits. So some people do find it useful to enlist the help of others in their efforts to change their habits, and that can be something that can spur you on if you let other people know that you're involved in this struggle against yourself, then that can really help you.
Peggy in Upper Sandusky, you're on the air with Jeremy Dean. He is the author of a new book about breaking habits. It's called Breaking Habits, Making Habits, Breaking Habits. Welcome to the show, Peggy.
Hi. I started an exercise routine. First, my motivation was that I cared for my mother who died of complications from congestive heart failure. And I found that the things that helped me was setting
Peggy, I hate to interrupt you. Could you pull your phone a little bit away from your mouth?
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
I found that by joining a gym and setting a certain time every day to do the exercise, that helped. Bringing a friend who also kept me accountable, and I was accountable to her, helped. And the motivation of my mother's illness all were great factors in helping to keep me on this exercise routine.
Thank you for your call.
Mm-hmm. I think there are two levels there. You've got sort of the motivation, the higher motivation to succeed, the thing that you're going for, whether it's giving up smoking or whether you're looking to ingrain new exercise habits. And that's great. You need that. And then you also need this low-level motivation. You need this kind of day-to-day sort of routine motivation. And that's more about making sure that everything's in place for your habits. You know that if you're going to the gym, then everything's ready to go, you know, that your clothes are ready and that, you know, that it's easy to get there and everything else is laid out. So there's no obstacles to you performing your habit. And exactly as that caller was saying, you also want to do it at a particular juncture in the day. I wouldn't necessarily say a particular time, but like at a particular juncture. So say you might do it after you had your when you get back from work, for example. You might then try to ingrain the habit of doing your exercise then. So yeah, this regularity is really important in habits.
Well, Jeremy Dean, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
Jeremy Dean, he's the author of Making Habits, Breaking Habits, Why We Do Things, Why We Don't, and How to Make Any Change Stick. Thanks for those great calls today as well. Coming up, we're going to talk about exercise and wanted to know from our listeners, if you have an exercise regimen that is just for a few minutes a day, what you do, how you do it. Share your story when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Facing doping allegations, Lance Armstrong had a tough relationship with sports reporters.
It is very telling, I think, that when he ultimately decides to come clean, he does it with someone who's not from that world.
Oprah Winfrey, Lance Armstrong, and the Fallen Cyclist's media strategy today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
And this is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. Stay with us right around noon. President Obama and Vice President Biden will speak about proposals related to gun violence. We will have coverage of that news conference whenever it begins here on 89.7 NPR News. Cloudy skies and a high of 36 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 26. Partly sunny and a high of 36 for Thursday. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing non-medical home health care and companionship to seniors in Central Ohio for over 16 years. More at homeinstead.com or 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead Senior Care. To us, it's personal. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
A common theme for exercise news and studies in 2012 is that the little things do add up. New York Times phys ed columnist Gretchen Reynolds recently wrote that the little things can make for a healthy or sometimes unhealthy lifestyle. She's back on the show to recap the best little things we learned from 2012 and to look ahead perhaps to what 2013 might bring. Gretchen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have a question for our listeners. Does your exercise regimen last about 20 minutes a day? Is it a little thing you do every day? Give us a call and share your story. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So, Gretchen, in your review of lessons in fitness science during 2012, what has piqued your interest this year that really stands out?
For me, the biggest lesson of all the science I read, and I read a lot of exercise-related science over the course of a year, was that there's a growing consensus among scientists, I believe, that a small amount of exercise, and not even exercise, let's call it activity, movement, can make a profound difference in someone's health, in their longevity, in their mood. It's really quite remarkable how much a little bit of movement can affect your life.
You mentioned in one of your columns that running longer distances doesn't necessarily add miles to your life. What does this mean for us more leisurely joggers? I mean, just taking a walk with the dog really does help. I'm feeling a lot better about walking my dog since I started talking with you, Gretchen.
I walk my dog every day, and sometimes we jog and sometimes we don't. There were a couple of really remarkable studies in 2012 looking at exercise and what and again, let's not call it exercise because some people simply hate that term, physical activity, what it could do for your lifespan. And what almost all of the studies found was a really quite moderate amount of exercise seems to be the sweet spot for living a long life, at least as long a life as is realistic for each of us.
Is this moderate every day?
No, it's moderate. The best studies show it's moderate about at least 3 or 4 times a week. And by moderate, that's maybe jogging for half an hour, walking for 45 minutes. And you don't have to walk pumping your arms really hard. It's a good idea to get your heart rate up. But any kind of movement appears to be really beneficial for increasing lifespan. And what was particularly notable about these studies was that doing a whole lot more does not add a lot to lifespan, and at some point appears to reduce it. So if you're not doing much more than walking most days, that's fine. You probably are right in the middle of the sweet spot.
Madeline in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. The reason I wanted to call is that I did become active about 3 years ago. I had never been a total couch potato, but my spouse was the runner. I was the kind of sort of once in a while. But the fellow who was on earlier, it's right. I now belong to the McConnell Heart Health Center. I have all my stuff in a locker. The biggest obstacle is getting through the door. And I do find that I really enjoy it now. I might jog on the track. I might swim. I might have a spa day and just float around in the hot pool. But I have really made a change and dropped about 10 pounds and feel just really great about doing it.
Yeah, I would actually love to expand just a little bit on what the last guest said. And I heard the tail end of the last question and answer, which does build on what you just said, which there does seem to be something really powerful about having a time of day or at least a time period when you are active and having everything set out so it's easy because it's so simple for us to find reasons not to. Things like my shoelace broke. Make sure your shoes are there. I really strongly recommend having a dog because dogs just sit there and look so sad if you don't take them out and walk around with them.
And I found
anything that you can find that makes it easier to be active is greatly to be commended.
And I do find that belonging to some sort of a health club is a the social aspect is also very wonderful for me personally. Thank you so much for the program.
Thank you, Madeline. Take care. Bob in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome, Bob. Hello, Bob. Bob, I guess.
Bob's off going for a run now.
Bob's not there. Okay. Sorry about that, Bob. We have an email from Christine. She says, at work, I walk at lunch and two other allotted breaks during the day, about 45 minutes total. When it is too cold or icy outside, I walk up and down the steps on my breaks. It has a great impact on my physical and mental well-being throughout the workday.
I think that's absolutely wonderful to hear, because many people, when it's cold and icy, would just sit at their desk. And it's really important to try and maintain activity patterns, even when it's cold. I would also point out that she is doing something that a lot of science from last year suggested is really beneficial, which is break up your activity into a number of smaller portions throughout the day. You don't have to do 30 or 40 minutes of walking all in a chunk. And in fact, for good health, particularly things related to blood pressure and appetite control, it may be better to do 3 10-minute sessions, 6 5-minute sessions. They all add up physiologically, and they may actually be more beneficial spread out throughout the day. So there really is no excuse not to do something.
My guest is Gretchen Reynolds. She's the phys ed columnist for the New York Times. If you have a question or comment, we'd like to hear what you do every day, what little thing you do every day to be active. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Justin in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah. How's everything going?
Good.
Yeah, I was telling the call screener that what I do is I take a 5x8 carpet and I put it on the floor and I call it my motivational mat. And I have to take the effort to put that carpet on the floor. And when it's there, it sounds silly, but it's a simple step of behaviors where once that's out, I'll use it and I'll do maybe 30 to 40 push-ups, 30 to 40 sit-ups, a handful of lunges. You could do a lot of stretching, but it's, for me, it's more about the action of taking the carpet out, placing it on top of carpet. I know it sounds kind of silly, but I say it's like the Aladdin's flying rug. So it's unique, but I am a certified personal trainer, so it's something that I can recognize with the previous comment. With the winter, it's cold, you don't want to go out, you know, you need anything you can to help you out, and you don't need weights. You know, we all have, I'm sure, a spare
I've got plenty of weight, right?
Yeah.
I walk around with weight every day.
I wouldn't say that, but no, I mean, even just using your own body weight and that in itself, you know, as the expert was mentioning, anything and everything that you can do in small portions, I personally like to call them fitness snacks. You know, during the day, we like to eat. We have a snack, a handful of peanuts, maybe a yogurt, a thing of string cheese. Well, just as you would take in small amounts of calories to keep your body going, you should be able to have a fitness snack. Go walk up a flight of stairs at work, or as opposed to smoking a cigarette, go for a little walk outside of the building. I mean, things like that. Just little things that don't take a lot of effort. And, yeah, hopefully that helps out.
All right. Thank you, Justin.
You're very welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I think the idea of having a little fitness carpet is actually a really wonderful idea, because many people need a sort of a totem to remind them that now is the time to do something. And also, as he mentioned, you do not need to belong to a gym in order to get a really sufficient and very helpful weight workout. I don't belong to a gym and haven't for quite a while because I'm very happy doing push-ups and, well, not happy, but I do push-ups and the crunches and the things that you need to do in order to work the muscles which you can do in 10 minutes first thing in the morning if you are so inclined. I would also say a lot of people and a lot of good science show that for many people, technology can be a really good way to motivate themselves. A lot of people find that the apps that they download to their phone that tell them how many steps they've taken, okay, an accelerometer, a pedometer.
This is 89.7 WOSU Columbus. We're ending our show a little early today, thanks to Gretchen Reynolds. Sorry about that, because we want to bring you live coverage of President Obama's announcement on his proposals to reduce gun violence.